This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, December 16th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Mark Meadows served as Donald Trump's fourth chief of staff from March 2020 through the end of his presidency. On January 6th, as rioters attacked the United States Capitol, many people attempted to communicate with the president through Meadows. Some of those messages are among the thousands of documents that Meadows handed over to the House Select Committee investigating the events of January 6th. This week, Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, the vice chair of the January 6th panel, read a number of them into the House record. They show that Meadows and others close to the president were fully aware of what was unfolding.
Members of Congress, the press, and others wrote to Mark Meadows as the attack was underway. One text Mr. Meadows received said, quote, "We are under siege here at the Capitol." Another, quote, "They have breached the Capitol." In a third, "Mark, protesters are literally storming the Capitol, breaking windows on doors, rushing in. Is Trump going to say something?" A fourth, "There's an armed standoff at the House chamber door." And another from someone inside the Capitol, "We are all helpless."
Other documents reveal that on January 6th, Meadows was communicating with the organizers of the Stop the Steal rally, which precipitated the riot, as well as with several Fox News personalities, conservative activists, and Donald Trump Jr., who told Meadows that his father has to lead now. After surrendering the documents, Meadows suddenly announced that he would not testify before the panel. On this Tuesday night, the House voted to recommend holding Meadows in criminal contempt of Congress and referred his case to the Justice Department for prosecution. Susan Glasser, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss what we've learned in recent weeks about the involvement of President Trump and his inner circle in the events of January 6th, and what these revelations might tell us about the future of Trump's relationship with his party. Hi, Susan. Welcome back.
Hi, Dorothy. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with Meadows, since that's the news of the week. Tell us a little bit about the events leading up to this indictment. Why was he cooperating with the committee in the first place, and why the about face?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. There's always a story and a complicated backstory, it seems, with Trump and his inner circle. So the backstory part of it has to do with Mark Meadows, like many, many of the Trump inner circle, seeking to sort of monetize and capitalize off of his position as having served as Trump's final chief of staff by producing a book, a memoir called The Chief's Chief, out this week. Not a bestseller, I might note. But interestingly, Donald Trump, I guess he, not famous for reading, clearly did not read this manuscript in advance, but he blurbed the book. He promoted it heavily. Then the reports about it came out about what was actually in it. And one of the things that was in it was Mark Meadows revealing that Donald Trump had, in fact, as many people suspected, tested positive for COVID before the first debate that he had with Joe Biden back in the 2020 election. Well, this created a whole wave of headlines and seemed to infuriate Donald Trump from his exile in Mar-a-Lago. And probably not coincidentally, Dorothy, that's exactly when Mark Meadows ceased his cooperation with the January 6th committee, filed a lawsuit against the January 6th committee and all of its members, basically asserted a form of executive privilege that's never been known to apply after a president was out of office.
And he must have been equally, Trump must have been equally furious that Meadows was testifying. He probably couldn't believe it.
Well, it may not have fully registered on him. It's unclear if at all Meadows consulted with Trump before handing over the texts and other materials he did hand over to the committee before he ceased cooperation. The other relevant, interesting piece of information, since we don't know yet exactly what drove him to cease cooperating, but is that the committee did subpoena the phone metadata from Mark Meadows' cell phone provider. And that, of course, could provide very significant and interesting information about the phone numbers that he was interacting with and when he was interacting with them, may reveal things that he did do on January 6th, or just as importantly, things he did not do, perhaps that he promised others he was doing.
When will we know his side of these conversations?
We may never. One of the remarkable things, as I'm looking back and working on, you know, a history of the 4 years of the Trump administration, Dorothy, is the extent to which the information blockade to, you know, essentially block and stonewall investigations, whether criminal investigations, Justice Department, Southern District of New York, or congressional investigations, they were remarkably successful to this day. Many of the key players have not testified at all to their side of what happened in key things like the Ukraine quid pro quo that led to Donald Trump's first impeachment. So it's quite possible that Mark Meadows will never hear a real, legitimate, under oath version of what his side of the story is.
So the committee was formed in July. Tell us a little bit about the work they've been doing and how Meadows fits into it.
You know, it's a very interesting investigative committee. There's obviously a lot of precedent for this. Often they've been joint select committees. For example, the Iran-Contra affair during Reagan's second term. But you have a situation now where it's just a House committee, and Republicans, in an unprecedented way, refused to participate, then appointed essentially a slate of election deniers to participate in this. Nancy Pelosi, again, breaking with precedent, said absolutely not, that's unacceptable, and refused to accept those members. And there are now two Republican members of the select committee. Those are the only two Republican members who, in effect, have definitively broken with the leadership of their party. Not ideologically, they're still Republicans. Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, in fact, are very conservative Republicans. Now, they have apparently been conducting a very wide-ranging investigation. They've interviewed over 300 witnesses, they say, thousands and thousands of documents, subpoenas. They say that they're getting private cooperation from even some of the people who helped to organize the Stop the Steal rally. And lots of people have come forward, including, they say, people who served inside the Trump White House to testify.
So what do we learn from the documents Meadows did turn over? What's advanced the story?
Well, we don't know exactly the full nature and range of what's in them. What we have seen is very tantalizing. And again, it suggests a pretty direct involvement by both the White House chief of staff and presumably the president himself in connecting with the people who were organizing not only the rally that ultimately ended up at the Capitol, but also the people who were pursuing spurious lawsuits and were connected to the members of Congress who organized the protests and vote against the electoral certification in the House that was sort of the trigger for this violent insurrection in the first place. And it appears that Meadows and Trump were really connected with the organizers of that effort in Congress.
To the extent, tell me if I'm wrong, that we do know have an email that Meadows wrote the day before the attack indicating that the National Guard was on standby to protect pro-Trump people.
Well, you know, Dorothy, that's an important point about that Meadows email, which is a very interesting email, because what he's saying in the email is not even true. you know, it's interesting that this is what they were saying to their followers, and there continued to be debates and disputes not yet settled by this investigation over the extent to which the National Guard in D.C. was ready to go. Why were they held back for several hours on January 6th itself? It's an unresolved point because we have not yet had a definitive investigation. And then to your question about more broadly, what else have we learned from Meadows? So we learned there were these frantic texts to Meadows from inside the Capitol, from members of Congress, from Fox News hosts like Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity. We also learned that he was being sent all manner of conspiracy theory and lie about the election, including this very inflammatory PowerPoint from one of this sort of fringy circle of people who were promoting the election lies. It recommends to the White House that not only it falsely get Mike Pence to invalidate the election results, but that it even declare a national emergency, presumably in order to call out the troops.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Let's get back to Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, who were among the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Trump the second time around. They are, as you mentioned, the only two Republicans who voted to form the January 6th committee and to serve on it. And they're the only Republicans who voted for criminal charges against Meadows. Kinzinger isn't running for re-election next year, but Cheney is, and she's facing a tough primary challenge from Harriet Hageman, a passionate Trump supporter. So are these just two of the last Never Trump Republicans in Congress going out in a blaze of glory? Or does Cheney believe there's a future for her in Republican politics?
Well, if there is right now, she doesn't look like she has a very, very large faction surrounding her. And it's, you know, the energy and the momentum and organizing power have all been in the other direction. And what's so remarkable is that we've really seen a Republican Party that's reorganized itself, not around any kind of ideological shift, but essentially has gone from being a sort of conventional political party with a range of beliefs to being almost a cult of personality. It's so notable to me that in the 2020 presidential election, the Republican Party, I think for the first time in its history, had no platform whatsoever. Its platform was essentially whatever Donald Trump wants to do in his second term, he should do. And, you know, it's a party that's essentially abdicated a kind of policy program or even vision for the country and said, our vision for the country is a man, not a movement. And it's an extraordinary shift. And I think it's symbolized by two very conservative Republicans like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger being so thoroughly marginalized by their party simply because they've broken with Trump over his lies about the election. Whereas you have these incredible fringe, out-of-control extremist QAnon-supporting members of Congress who are much more in the mainstream of the House Republican caucus right now than Liz Cheney.
And Trump has all but announced that he'll run for president again in 2024. But there's also speculation that some pro-Trump politicians might be preparing to compete, including probably most notably Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, Nikki Haley, the former ambassador to the UN, Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, and even Mike Pence, Trump's vice president. What are you hearing?
Well, I wouldn't take it as an absolute certainty that Donald Trump will run for president again in 2024. I think that certainly it is very much in his interest, including, by the way, his financial interest, to continue to make people believe that he's going to run for president and that he remains relevant, therefore, for as long as possible. So I don't think we'll know definitively until the last possible moment. Look at the enormity of the psychological blow it was for Donald Trump to lose election in 2020. He has, in fact, created an entire national and even constitutional crisis as a result of this defeat that he could not accept. The prospect of a second defeat seems like it would be even quite crippling for Donald Trump. The flip side is he's essentially given up the business that you know consumed him in his life before politics. I think he remains obsessed and focused on his political career and his political movement. And if he saw a clear path to returning to the White House, and you know, look at the cratering of Joe Biden's polls and political standing over the last 6 months, obviously that has probably made it a lot more attractive to Donald Trump to run again for office. But the key thing that he'll be watching for, that we'll all be watching for, is what happens in the midterm elections next year. And do Republicans, as currently expected, win back control of the House of Representatives? Do they win back the Senate? That will obviously shape the political landscape in which Trump actually makes a decision.
Just on DeSantis for a second, because he's had a pretty Trump has had a pretty close relationship with him. He is a Trumpist candidate. Some think that he could assume Trump's populist mantle without all of the political and legal and financial liabilities. Is that possible, or does the movement need Donald Trump himself to survive?
Well, look, I think the last year has reinforced that Trumpism is a force in American politics with Donald Trump and without Donald Trump, and that in many ways it's a sort of mutually reinforcing relationship where the base, as Trump calls it and obsesses over, drives him and other politicians as much as they drive them. And actually, vaccines are an interesting example of that. Donald Trump was vaccinated. He would want to claim this as one of his great accomplishments, but instead of being hailed as the creator of Operation Warp Speed, you know, the COVID denialism and vaccine denialism within the Republican Party base meant that Donald Trump was actually booed at a rally when he mentioned the vaccine, and you don't hear him talking about that much anymore. So the question of the Trumpist base and how will it exist if Donald Trump is not their standard bearer? Absolutely, there are politicians who can take up, you know, the sort of mantle of right-wing populism in this country, the attacks on the electoral system and disenfranchising voters have occurred in dozens of states since the election. And Donald Trump is not personally orchestrating all those, right? You know, there are many, many people at this point who have taken part in the transformation of the Republican Party. And so it's very hard to imagine that momentum suddenly shifting and reversing course.
In Cheney's remarks to about Meadows this week, she said, "We cannot surrender to President Trump's efforts to hide what happened. We will be persistent, professional, and nonpartisan." You know, that's true to a point, but of course it is a political process. And the more damage that Democrats especially can do to Trump and his minions in Congress, the better.
Well, you know, it's really striking. I mean, think back to what your expectations were on January 7th. You know, the leadership on Capitol Hill, Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell were furious with Donald Trump. It seemed that Donald Trump was over, spent, gone, and going to be purged as a force from his party. And that is very much not where we are at the end of the year. More Republicans, by many polls, actually believe Trump's election lies now than did on January 7th of 2021. And so I think that, you know, this is a long-term process and battle for control of the narrative of what has even happened. And it's an unresolved one.
Yeah. And I noticed that Mitch McConnell this week was unwilling to make a strong statement one way or the other about the Meadows revelations. He just sort of did his, you know, we'll see what happens thing.
Well, you know, McConnell's very interesting. They're now, you know, Trump hates McConnell. McConnell remains, as you know, an extremely partisan Republican, but he has no quarter for Donald Trump or for the election lie. He made a scathing speech in the aftermath of Trump's second impeachment. He did not support that impeachment, but he said 100% that he holds Trump responsible for the insurrection at the Capitol. They have not spoken in over a year since McConnell told Donald Trump that he was going to be accepting Joe Biden's presidential victory and congratulating him. And so, you know, now Trump wants to purge McConnell and take him on as the Senate
Republican leader. We'll see if that actually happens or not. But McConnell's of the faction, and it's a small faction of the party at this point, that wants to move on from Donald Trump, that doesn't want to talk about his excesses, even to condemn them, but just wants to look forward and almost pretend that this whole mess didn't happen. I don't think he's going to be successful in that, but he's sort of the leader of that faction of Republicans.
Yeah, after enabling him for 4 years. But
absolutely.
Regardless. So the anniversary of the insurrection is only a few weeks away. I wondered what you expect to be seeing and hearing from the committee at the beginning of the new year. Will there be public hearings? How is it going to unfold?
You know, that's a great question. We don't yet have visibility into how this is going to unfold. They have given us some really big numbers in terms of the numbers of witnesses called, the number of documents and sort of investigative information they've acquired so far. One problem is the long-term success that Trump and his people have had with tying up congressional investigations with these court cases. And in fact, the Steve Bannon contempt case isn't even going to get a hearing until well into next year, the election year. And so we may never get his testimony, or will they hold up the entire investigation's results in order to get testimony from people like Bannon and Meadows? And that's a huge problem, of course. It was a really successful method by which Trump and his administration avoided testimony. Some of the lawsuits that they set in motion at the very beginning of Democratic control of the House of Representatives are only being decided now. Just this week, they were dealing with a lawsuit involving Donald Trump's tax returns and whether they need to be handed over to the House Ways and Means Committee. The House Ways and Means Committee demanded those tax returns in early 2019, and we're just getting court rulings now.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Dorothy, thank you.
Susan B. Glasser is a staff writer at The New Yorker. She and Peter Baker are working on a history of the Trump White House. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.